The Hammer of Truth and Common Sense is back just 48 hours after that fairly epic show on Tuesday. I hope you all enjoyed that series. It was fun doing it. Time consuming, but still fun to do. And so what happens next is the next question. Well, we'll find out some more in today's show. And no doubt in the up and coming more must listen to shows that are in the pipeline, at least two, possibly three. This is the Truth, Honour and Integrity Show. My name's Thomas Williams. Enjoy the show. Right, welcome to the show. And you wish to know why we have to build a coalition of we the people. This piece reveals it all. Multiple world leaders, including officials with the US and Ukrainian governments, walked out of a group of 20, the G20 meeting in Washington on Wednesday when Russian officials began to speak. They all walked out. In particular, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen, born in, born to, no surprise. And Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell were amongst the global economic leaders who left when the Russian officials began to speak. And among the others exiting the meeting were Chrystia Freeland, again, no surprise, Deputy Crime Minister of Canada, and Christine Lagarde, whoever he is, President of the European Central Bank, as well as several European officials left the meeting. It's beyond pathetic, disgraceful, and extremely juvenile on all levels, and an utter disgrace to the people that they are supposed to be representing, remember. All clowns who walked out should be fired by their respective countries. We've got a region at war, and these people walk out of discussions about it, and that says it all, really. This week, as promised, we archived our Facebook page, and it no longer accepts new members, posts, or comments on the page. I know this disappoints some, but we all have to make small sacrifices in this war and cannot and will not allow clowns to interfere or manipulate us. In fact, all in the alt media should walk away en masse from Facebook. It hits them in their pocket badly and leaves them a message, we the people will not tolerate having our opinions and beliefs trampled on. Message to Facebook and Zuckerberg with a silent F. Have this. I hope you all sang along to that. Somebody else who's decided they've had enough as well is Texas. And they've had enough of the immigrant issue on the border and sent busloads of them to Washington, D.C. Now, personally, I would have sent them all to Biden and Pelosi's home and parked it outside, since they want it. And then the White House mirror of anti-truth and fake COVID woman Psaki described it sarcastically as being nice of them. But the point is, with Biden in office now for 15 months, what have they done to alleviate it? Nothing. Have they sent extra funds to Texas to deal with the problem? No. And so all of that issues is then pushed onto the state of Texas and subsequently onto the Texas taxpayer. This week, passengers on airplanes, trains and other public transport in the US don't have to wear masks anymore, after a federal judge struck down the mandate. And the US TSA, Total Sexual Assholes, and the CDC said orders requiring masks on public transportation would no longer be enforced, although both agencies recommended their continued use. Well, you carry on then and act like bots. But the US District Judge Catherine Kimball Mizell vacated the mask requirement nationwide on Monday and directed the CDC to reverse the policy that was put in place in February 2021. Now, the ruling was handed down in a lawsuit that was filed last year by the Health Freedom Defense Fund, which is a non-profit group that says it focuses on bodily autonomy as a human right. And the court decision means the CDC's public transportation masking order is now not in effect at this time, according to an administration official. And then it said the TSA will not enforce its security directives and emergency amendment requiring mask use on public transportation and transportation hubs at this time. The White House press secretary and Ministry of Lies, Jen Psaki, called the judge's ruling a disappointing decision and said we're continuing to recommend that people wear masks while the administration considers its legal options. All whilst she herself has rarely been seen with one on, I might add, right through the scandemic. A headline last week appeared on April 14th from an incident that happened on April 4th in the news. And it said, white police officer fatally shoots black man in the head. But it was kept out of the public news for 10 days. Why did they do that? Because news is designed for impact of the programs they run on us is why. And with a black man arrested for the New York event, they conveniently needed a counterpunch story. And so a day later, a 10-day-old news story was released. Now, as for the incident, the guy shot, attempted to run away, and also fought with the officer and had hold of his stun gun. But that was buried further down the story. But is that mitigating circumstances for the cop to shoot him? In my opinion, no. Let's break this down rationally, shall we? How can a traffic stop of a car's out-of-date registration lead to someone losing their life? If he's running away, let him run. He can be picked up at a later date, and surely that is a better way to police than ending up in a brawl and shooting someone over a motoring offence. Why does the interaction always have to be confrontational? Well, that's what happens when you send cops to the Israeli SS. Just for motoring offences. That's just ridiculous tactics. That has not only cost a man his life, but it's also changed the rest of the life for that cop as well. And the police authorities need to radically alter the way they approach these incidences, because no minor motoring offence should lead to someone being injured or killed. They've got the registration of the car. They've got photographic or video evidence when it suits them, I might add. Let the guy or girl run away. They can pull them in at a later date. Vice President Kamala Harris, Chief of Staff Tina Flournoy, we've mentioned her before, or someone of that name anyway, is leaving the Biden-Harris administration and will be replaced by veteran White House staffer Lorraine Vols. Now, Harris's office has also preceded anticipated shuffling, yeah, just like Biden, he shuffles around, and turnover in the West Wing with White House Press Secretary and Ministry of Lies Jen Psaki, amongst others, also eyeing exits in the coming week. Now, Vol's promotion comes as Harris has seen a turnover on her communications and national security teams in recent weeks, including Jamal Simmons, a former CBS news analyst, who took over from Simone Sanders as communications director, Philip Gordon, a Clinton and Obama administration veteran, is now National Security Advisor after Nancy Mikhail Downey stepped down. Rebecca Lisner, a former National Security Council official, joined the Vice President as Deputy National Security Advisor last week. And Dean Lieberman, not another Lieberman, born in, born to, former State Department official, also recently joined as a special advisor and speech writer. You'll have your work cut out with that, mate. I'll tell you that for nothing. Speech writer. Now, the rats are deserting the sinking ship, and in some cases being replaced with more Jewish elite puppets, no doubt. The UK and the post office there handled a record £3.2 billion in cash in March, a report has revealed, and I think that's a good sign. £3.2 billion is roughly $3.9 billion. And it was the first time since December, Christmas, that cash deposits and withdrawals exceeded £3 billion, highlighting its popularity despite a move towards a cashless society. And personal cash deposits were up 15% month on month, with the highest reaching £1.31 billion, with the previous highest in December of £1.27 billion. Business cash deposits also rose 15% month on month to £1.09 billion, whereas the previous highest amount was £1.06 billion in September 2021. Also, personal cash withdrawals at post office counters were up 20% to £779 million. That's a good sign. Cash is king, as far as we're concerned, because it allows the individual control over their lives. Without the data mining collection services the debit and credit cards provides. And my advice is always hold it back a cash nest egg away from the banks if you are able to do so. We've heard about the inflation rate in the US, but there's another one in the UK. It went up 7% in March, which is the highest level recorded since 1992, according to the Office of National Statistics. And data released on Wednesday showed that the largest contributors to the trend were increased fuel prices and energy bills. All deliberate. And the consumer price index rose from 6.2 in February and was higher than expected, with economists having predicted a rate of 6.7 and it went to 7%. Now, from April 1st, the UK energy regulator increased the household energy price cap by 54%. 54% for the energy, home energy. Following a surge in energy prices, which they created, including a record rise in global petrol or gas prices. Liquid fuel prices have more than doubled over the past year, up 113.9%, driving up costs for families who rely on oil to heat their homes, while motor fuel was up 30%. Now, the average petrol or gas prices grew by 12.6 pence a litre, which is 62 cents a gallon, between February and March, which was the largest monthly increase since records began in 1990. Remember Biden back in January saying the US gas prices would go down below $3, just watch it. Yeah, right. You know, we're 3 weeks into now when he released the million barrels of oil per day. Have the prices gone down? No. It's a program. And this compares to a rise of 3.5 pence a litre between the same months of 2021, and diesel prices saw spikes of 18.8 pence per litre, which is roughly 85 cents a gallon. And British inflation rates are likely to rise and remain at record highs throughout 2022, according to Boris Glass, who is a senior economist at S&P Global Ratings. And the raising of the cap on household energy bills will add an extra point or so by the end of this month. Now, the surge in inflation always hits household budgets hard, especially those on lower incomes who now have exhausted pandemic savings. And whilst they said the short term is set to be painful, the bulk of high inflation should start falling as early as next winter if global energy prices do not continue to further rise, he said. If. All manipulated markets designed to harvest all the funds up, and the multi-billionaire people running this game on the people have much to answer for and to be accountable to we the people. This impacts the sub-millionaires, all of them. And inflation is a snake-level tax on the people that too few understand it. And it is insidious to implement it at a stage of crisis. But that is how they operate. In chaos for their order, and it's time for all to create order out of their chaos. Still in the UK, there's quite a few pieces about the UK tonight, including an expose. But on Sunday night, some UK people decided they had enough of excessive energy prices for the home. And thousands of people in the UK completely switched off their electricity to demand that the government take action on the energy crisis. Now, it's described as a non-partisan action protest, and it was organised online to draw attention to the impacts of the rising price of electricity across the country. And those that took part are also hoping that it will hit energy companies where it hurts. Now, the idea is that if it won't put you at risk, you switch off all of your electrical appliances, lights or switches at the breaker for just 10 minutes. And this then creates an imbalance in the UK's national grid when electricity consumption becomes lower than predicted and the electricity supply is then too great. And because the grid is publicly owned, but the power supply is private, this effectively creates a 10-minute boycott of the privatised portions of their power supply, losing them up to an estimated £9 million in revenue for just 10 minutes. Now, a quarter of a million households took part, it was revealed, and the hashtag for the campaign is #BigPowerOff, was trending on Twitter in the UK on Sunday night, and organisers are now hoping to hold these blackouts weekly to grow the momentum of the movement and have greater influence on the government's decisions. And there was another protest planned for 7 p.m. British Standard Time on April 16th. Good stuff. I was wondering why that snake was quiet. And lo and behold, he's slithered to the surface again. As an expert panel advising Saudi Arabia's National Wealth Fund objected to investing billions of dollars into a private equity firm created by the former US presidential advisor Jared Kushner, just months after he left office. And Kushner sought to secure $2 billion in investment from Saudi Arabia's public investment fund for his firm Affinity Partners. Now, the project was reviewed by a 5-person committee advising the Saudi body, and the newspaper reported citing minutes of their communications, and the Saudis had serious reservations about it, according to the report. Now, experts were concerned about the lack of financial experience amongst the firm's management and the fact that the Saudi fund would become the primary investor, and the operational practices that they found unsatisfactory in all aspects, and the proposed management fees that they deemed excessive. In other words, it's a cash bailout for Kushner. That's what it tells you. Proposed management fees. Now, advisors also raised the issue of transparency surrounding the idea of pouring billions of dollars into a company run by a former senior official in the Trump administration whose coziness with Saudi Arabia was well recorded. And Kushner served as a presidential advisor. No, he wasn't an advisor. He told Trump what to do. And a punt man for Middle East affairs. And he is credited with pushing through a series of rapprochement agreements between Israel and Gulf states known as the Abraham Accords. Yes, because he was working on behalf of Israel is why, not America. Now, the committee meeting, said the Corden's report, days later after the committee meeting, the advice was overruled by the Saudis Bund Board funds. And the NYT reported implied that the decision came from the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Perhaps we should ask him, how's Mr. Khashoggi? And the report noted that Affinity Partners sought to raise $7 billion from various investors throughout the world, but has fallen short of the goal so far. $7 billion. What for? And according to the latest public disclosure at the end of March, the firm had $2.5 billion under its management, and most of it was Saudi money. Saudis are Jewish, remember, House of Saud, all Jews. But isn't it funny that that was never disclosed whilst doing backdoor arms deals with the Saudis? Remember Trump's selling all kinds of military equipment? Now, the newspaper contrasted the investment with that made by the Saudi fund at about the same time into another private equity firm created by former US Treasury Secretary and snake Steven Mnuchin. Oops. And according to the article, Mnuchin, an experienced investor with a record of successful management, except at the Treasury, got half of what Kushner did. And Mnuchin's firm, Liberty Strategic Capital, raised $2.7 billion from a total of 33 investors, according to its filings at the SEC. But Mnuchin, another snake out of the Treasury, that managed to get a cushy job and pay, despite working against the American public, all whilst collecting heavy pensions from the American public for life. And that has to stop. Given all of these politicians are involved in several companies, both during and after office, courtesy of lobbying and backdoor deals, why should the American people pay them their full pay for the rest of their life? Because that's greed. Now, the newspaper remarked that no law or rules constrain the investment activities of former administration officials after leaving the White House. There's no rules in it either. And many from both parties have profited from connections and experiences gained in government. Indeed. Now, the update on Kushner's financial deals with Saudi Arabia came weeks after the newspaper reported the progress in a US federal investigation of controversial dealings by Hunter Biden. And he is suspected of cashing in on his family name and acting as a foreign agent without properly declaring himself as such, as well as tax violations and fiddling with children, I might add. Now, among other things, a new newspaper confirmed the authenticity of materials from a laptop which were reported by the New York Post in the run-up to the 2020 election. And the story was infamously suppressed by big tech and dismissed as Russian propaganda. Yeah, right. The rise in truth overcoming the lie speeds up and converges in an avalanche of dot connections so we can all see. And Greta Thunberg is the latest gaffe, following Biden and many others, when she said, since the climate crisis doesn't exist, there's a long line of revealings that has embarrassed the old establishment. They can't help it. Want to know why there's so many faux pas on national news and politicians? Because the truth frequency is here. And all of it done by their own puppets. And this has increased since March 21st, 2020, of what I believe was the official day of the Svarog. Deep state clowns confirmed it by declaring martial law that very same day, only to retract and repackage it by declaring a health and safety risk called COVID. All designed for COVIDiots to follow the old order again at great cost to themselves and those of us who saw through it. Now, the dark forces can still play in the day of the Svarog, But as I warned back then, more would be able to see them for exactly what they are. And no amount of blocking, deleting, fact-checking is going to stop the rise of the absolute truth. Rita is here for the next 1,006 years. Let's make the best use of it. Some medical news now before we go into the break. And yet more shameful tactics under the banner of COVID. And it shows how far so many have fallen with tactics like these. Take the bow of shame, the Cleveland Clinic, as its vaccination policy is preventing Dane Donaldson from donating a kidney to his 9-year-old son, Tanner, despite his being an almost perfect match. Why? Because the clinic's policy is that all patients and donors who are still living must be fully vaccinated against the fake COVID-19 in order for surgery to be performed on them, and it appears that no exceptions are being made in the case of the Donaldsons. Total national Zionists. And the staff tolerate this? Your stances are going to be shamed for many a year. All doctors and nurses who complied with this. Now, Tanner was born with one kidney, and right now it functions at between 18 and 20%, and his condition is currently being managed, but sooner or later he's going to need a transplant. Now, he was born with a birth defect called posterior urethral valves, which is a valve that blocks urine from exiting the body. That's the... Now, the Donaldson family have decided for personal reasons not to take the vaccine at all. That's also common sense. And the idea that everybody needs to be vaccinated was a little bit thrown down our throats, they said, everywhere we turned. So the more it became prevalent, and the more just studying it of what's involved in it, is there informed consent? He asked. Do I get to see the ingredient list? Good questions that the Liars Club won't answer. Now, a similar incident happened in October last year at the University of Colorado Hospital, where an unvaccinated patient waiting for a transplant was taken off the waiting list. Another such incident happened in February this year at a hospital in Texas, where a teenager was denied surgery and almost denied even basic appointments and lab work due to him being unvaccinated. Also in Waukesha, Wisconsin, as well as many other locations nationwide, a vaccine mandate for workers led to severe staff shortages at a children's hospital, impacting their ability to give proper care to patients. It's just fascist behaviour. And it's all leading to the digital world, where you won't be able to do or receive anything without the junta's approval. And stupid people are going along with this. Nursing is supposed to be about care, not bureaucracy. And why are they not screaming out against their own employers? It seems common sense and decency has become a byword in their fear-laden world. And maybe it's a positive action group effort is required on this. Documentary evidence of Washington's aggressive plans for developing and manufacturing biological weapons in secret US biological laboratories in Ukraine, which is banned by international conventions, that has been uncovered during the Russian special operation to denazify and demilitarize Ukraine. Now, although suspicions of such US activities have already been repeatedly published in many media outlets, and their verification and official confirmation of such criminal anti-human plans by Washington was one of the goals of Moscow's special operation in Ukraine. Now, it should have been addressed a long time ago, that the international community and international institutions should have initiated an independent inspection of the near 400 secret Pentagon biological laboratories that are scattered all around the world, whose location in specific countries is clearly linked to the theatres of future US military action against adversaries. But what is kind of left out of this is, and this will be addressed in this piece, is the unconditional involvement of Britain, which has long collaborated with the US in the development of chemical and biological weapons and has been ignored in relation to such criminal plans. Thus, the US Federal Contractor Registry shows that the Pentagon has spent more than $70 billion in recent years alone. Imagine what that could do for the American people, $70 billion. On experiments with deadly viruses and nerve agents at the Porton Down Military Biological Laboratory, which is located near Salisbury in Great Britain. It also houses an off-world base. Oops. And the US Defense Threat Reduction Agency, led by the US Department of Defense, has funded a number of defense projects at this so-called Defense Science and Technology Laboratory at Porton Down. And these include experimental infection of primates with anthrax, Ebola, Marburg, Venezuelan equine encephalitis, Western and Eastern equine encephalitis viruses, and poisoning of animals with mustard gas and phosgene. It is also well known that experiments with LSD has been incapacitating British troops during exercises, MKUltra. And the testing of chemicals on humans, however, was not out of the ordinary for the Porton Down facility. According to a report, in 1963, Porton Down staff decided to test the vulnerability of public infrastructure to chemical and biological attacks by spreading a bacterium on the London Underground, which was initially thought to be harmless, but turned out to be quite capable of causing septicemia. Now, the DTRA, the American version, has full access to all scientific and technical developments at the Porton Down Laboratory, and such experiments involving animals are considered secret in Great Britain. And it's also a criminal offence under Chapter 24 of the Animals Scientific Procedures Act to reveal information about such experiments. The classic National Security Act again. The Zero Oversight Act and the Zero Accountability Act is what it really means. Criminal offence to reveal that animals are being abused and exposed to experiments. But the great question is, how are politicians passing these bills? Because that is a dereliction of duty to the people themselves. And according to information received by the media, military experiments with chemical and biological weapons have increased at Porton Down in recent years. And thus, between 2005 and 2016, 122,000 animals were infected with deadly viruses or poisoned with chemicals. Now, the fake laboratory uses mice, guinea pigs, rats, piglets, ferrets, sheep and monkeys in its research. And it's also known that the British military fake scientists received funding from the DTRA to develop a chemical testing system from 2012, round about the same time of the Ukraine facility, to 2017 with experiments on the effects of VX and VM poisoning agents being conducted at Porton Down in 2015. In 2013, scientists from Porton Down sprayed gas on the London Underground, which the British government tried to keep quiet about and not tell its citizens. Now, at the time, thousands of people were gassed without their knowledge, and no one asked for their consent to take part in such barbaric research against their own people. But nevertheless, the data about this is recorded in a British Home Office document, telling also about other programmes conducted jointly by the United States and Britain. Now, information about the UK DSTL group testing of the chemical poison VX on guinea pigs was posted on the US National Centre for Biotechnology Information website back in August 2018. On September 1st, 2018, a report emerged on behalf of 10 more researchers at the UK lab about testing Bioscavenger, which is an effective delayed therapeutic, where have we heard that word before, intervention for VX chemical weapons poisoning. Now, the DSTL itself officially admitted in mid-2016 that they were producing the poisonous substance and testing it on animals. The American said is a foreign major client of the UK's DSTL. A bit like GCHQ and NSA then, and OSS and CIA. All the same people, all the same group. Now, between 2012 and 2017, the British military scientists received $39.7 million for the Pentagon's chemical system testing program. And judging by the US federal procurement system, the DSTL and the DTRA collaboration continues. And yet again, it's more evidence the Pentagon is not only running insidious programs on the people, but getting Americans to pay for it again. And the Pentagon and the DOD have been shown in these past 2 years alone to have handed out exorbitant sums of money that brings zero benefits to we the people, least of all those who are tasked to pay for it, the Americans themselves. It's a national and global disgrace that has and is unfolding by these harbingers of doom and death, and the public must raise awareness to stop this madness. Now, the Porton Down secret laboratory has repeatedly been at the centre of scandals involving human experimentation. Up to 20,000 people participated in litigation with the DSTL from 1949 to 1989, and in 2008, the UK Ministry of Defence paid 360 veterans £3 million without admitting responsibility. And according to The Guardian, in the late 2000s, the US and Britain experimented with biological weapons in Afghanistan using a specially bred fungus called Fusarium oxysporum and Pleospora papaveraceae to kill poppy crops. Maybe that's what shut down the fields in Afghanistan, and then only for them to go over and fight there to put them back on. Now, in 2000, the international NGO Sunshine Project published a report on the dangers of this fungus infecting and killing not only cocoa, poppy and cannabis, but also other plants in environmentally sensitive areas of Asia and the New World. Now, an indication of the dangers of such fungi is the fact that their use is banned in the US. But it's okay to spread it elsewhere then. And according to the Sunshine Project report, genetically modified strains of the fungus have been bred in the US, which means that the deliverables can be classified as biological weapon. And given this information alone, the extent of Britain's involvement in the possible development with the US of biological weapons already needs to be investigated in full detail. In fact, everyone who is involved in this really needs to be fully investigated on a global scale. Biowarfare is the weapons of utter cowards. And yet they all stand there acting tough with their badges of dishonour for killing people, thinking they're all so tough, when the reality is you're all cowards. All of you. Anyone using biowarfare is an utter coward of the lowest order. Not content with that, a new document detailing what the US Air Force is up to has been revealed. They're using what is called synovial tissue RNA samples, location 502D, contracting squadron. And in it, it details the contracting line elements within the contract. And line one says, 27 samples of normal human fresh frozen synovial tissue of Russian or Caucasian origin. 12 samples of normal human ribonucleic acid, which is RNA, samples from Russian and Caucasian only. Now, the technical specifications makes things quite clear. All normal human fresh frozen synovial tissue and normal human RNA samples must only be obtained from a Russian or Caucasian. All fresh frozen synovial tissue and RNA samples must come from normal donors who have no musculoskeletal injuries. And a question was asked, would you consider samples that are Ukrainian? The answer was, no, all samples must be Russian and must be Caucasian. The government will not consider tissue samples from the Ukraine. The From His Story to Our Story has revealed why in its fullest scope and also measure. Indeed, we're not. There's been a lot of verbiage about alternative energy. Except the evidence of experts being jackasses and not having a plan for it is laid to bear in this mini expose. And the reason being is the energy storage problem that is inherent in the effort to eliminate fossil fuels from the electricity generation system and then replace them with wind and solar power. Now, other than nuclear power, the storage problem is the critical issue that must be addressed if there is ever going to be net zero electricity generation, let alone a net zero economy based on all energy usage having been electrified. And the problems of trying to provide enough storage to back up a fully wind and solar system without fossil fuels are so huge and so costly that you would think that everyone pushing the net zero agenda would be completely focused on these issues. Now, given the issues, you would think the experts would be aware of feasibility studies, cost studies, and demonstration projects to make their case on how their plans could be accomplished. And yet, that is not the case. Because if you read about the plans and proposals in various quarters for net zero, you quickly realise that the people pushing this agenda have no clue. What a surprise that is. So, let's look at the discussions of the storage situation coming out of three jurisdictions: California, Australia, and New York. No surprise, two of them are involved. They always are. But it is clear that wind and solar generators have substantial periods when they generate nothing and other times when they generate far less than the users demand. And based on actual historical patterns of usage and generation from wind and solar sources, you will find that to have a fully wind solar generation system and make it through a year without a catastrophic failure, you will need approximately a 3 times overbuild of the wind solar system, plus storage for something in the range of 24 to 30 days of average usage. So it needs to be 3 times larger, and then a storage system to back it up. And for these purposes, usage at any given moment is measured in gigawatts, but usage for some period of time is measured in gigawatt hours, not gigawatts. Now, California's average electricity use for 2020 was about 31 gigawatts, Australia 26, and New York about 18. Now, to calculate how much storage you need in gigawatt hours, you just multiply the average use in gigawatts by 30 days and then 24 hours per day. I know you people at Johns Hopkins are not capable of doing that, and I'm not going to explain it to you. Go back to school. So, California will need about 22,302 gigawatts of storage, Australia 18,720, and New York about 12,960, which is all lower than the current use, and that is to supply current levels of demand. Current levels. Now, for the everything must be electrified case, you have to triple all these numbers, 67,000 for California, 56 for Australia, and 38,000 gigawatt hours for New York. But when you price that out at current costs of the Tesla-type lithium-ion batteries, which is $150 per kilowatt hour, and you will get around a price of around $10 trillion for California, $8.4 trillion for Australia, and $5.8 trillion for New York to build it out at the current prices. And these figures are in the range of triple the amount of GDP for all three of those jurisdictions. And that's before you even get to the cost of the three times overbuild of the generation system to account for charging of the batteries when the sun is shining and the wind is blowing. And these Tesla-style batteries can't hold charges for months on end, as would be necessary for this system. But at this point, it seems like a minor quibble based on those figures. Now, in a Californian energy magazine, they ran a piece with the title, California's Solar Market is Now a Battery Market. And the gist is that California's solar developers have now caught on to the need to pair batteries with their projects, and that therefore new projects going forward are as much battery projects as solar panel projects. And it said California is on the cusp of no longer being a solar market where batteries are being added. Instead, it is becoming a battery market that sometimes includes solar. And so how much battery capacity is being added by the new projects? Well, according to the American Clean Power Association, California has only added 256 megawatts, not gigawatts, megawatts, of utility-scale batteries before 2020, but had reached 2.1 gigabytes, or gigawatts, sorry, by the end of 2021, which was an eightfold increase, which all sounds very good, except it's massively short. Because the 256 solar plus storage projects, representing 72 gigawatts of solar and 64 gigawatts of batteries, make up the vast majority of the hybrid projects in California. But a recent analysis suggests that the state needs 37 gigawatts of batteries over the next 20 years, as well as 53.2 gigawatts of utility scale solar. And no one asked or revealed, how about the amount of gigawatt hours that California will need? But if those 64 gigawatts of batteries you are planning to buy only to store energy for 1 hour, then you will need to multiply your purchase by a factor of 1,000. Oops. And if they store energy for about 4 hours, then multiply your purchase by a factor of 250. And the report says, could they really be so far off from the actual problem? Well, I'm afraid that answer is yes. And I'm also not surprised. Now, over in Australia, it appears that they have people who have figured it out, that they need to measure the storage requirements for wind solar backup in gigawatt hours rather than gigawatts. And a piece from in March of Energy Storage News headline, Australia surpassed 1 gigawatt hour of annual battery storage developments during 2021, and described it as huge progress. Just one gigawatt hour when they need 18,720. And so, how much more is in the pipeline? Well, there's around 1,000 megawatt hours of grid-scale energy storage currently under construction, but the development of pipeline of projects is a massive 57 gigawatt hours compared to 18,720 that is required. A massive 57 gigawatts. Mind boggle. But that's the gigawatts. No one appears to have told them that they're going to need 56,160 gigawatt hours, not 57, to fulfill their net zero fantasies. And like California, they're off by a factor of 1,000. Now, the Tesla-type battery installation for a mere 150 megawatt hours, which is less than a sixth of 1 gigawatt hour. And it looks like they're going to need 400,000 plus of these installations. And also the fact that these Tesla-style batteries have no ability to store energy without loss for months on end. Now in New York, they have a statute passed in 2019 that requires statewide greenhouse gas emissions to be cut to 60% of 1990 levels by 2030. And since electricity is less than a third of final energy consumption, this would necessarily mean that all fossil fuel electricity generation will all be gone in 8 years. Except there's one massive problem with that. So, how did they set about to do that? Well, they had a collection of panels and advisory bodies, and they've been putting out reams of reports, thousands of pages in the aggregate, and yet no batteries are yet under construction. It's a story. And rather than proposing a massive build of batteries, New York's so-called experts think they have a better idea called the DEFR, which stands for Dispatchable Emissions Free Resource. And what that exactly is, as far as Chiara can determine, it's something that hasn't even been invented yet. Thousands of papers and panels and advisory bodies for something that hasn't even been invented. Now, it links to a March 24th report from New York's Independent System Operator, or better known as a PLANC, and Title System and Resource Outlook Update. And after 17 pages of incomprehensible gibberish, you will come to this on page 18. Remember, they're going net zero in 2030. DEFR builds allowed starting in 2030. Input assumption adjusted, first allowable year for DEFR builds advanced to 2030. Caveats: significant uncertainty related to cost or availability of DEFR technologies, as well as regulatory definitions of zero emissions compliant technologies. Assumption is not based on estimate of realistic timeline for potential DEFR additions. Observations: DEFR capacity build earlier on in model horizon, although comparable capacity builds by 2040. decreased fossil capacity, primarily earlier retirements and less new builds, offset by earlier DEFR capacity additions. And it said, yes, we are to be completely dependent on so-called DEFR technologies, which have not been invented yet, and as to which significant uncertainties exist. Could this get any more ridiculous? I told you, they don't have a plan for anything. And it's the same as the electric cars. You know, we're going zero electricity, and then we're all going to have electric cars. Hello, McFly. But the sheer lack of infrastructure to accommodate those electric cars is going to run into trillions. They didn't think of that, you see. And every single gridlock, particularly where we have volumes of snow, will lead to every electric car going flat, waiting in the gridlock. And then you would need a raft of tow trucks just to unblock the highways. Oh dear, these people are stupid. Now, on the back of this, Volkswagen may have developed a major hydrogen breakthrough, and cars could travel 200 kilometres on a single tank of fuel. Just see that going ahead. Not. Though the latest trend has been electric cars, these have also a number of technical drawbacks like range, cost, mining and weight, and also how to dispose of millions of tons of batteries. Something the previous story didn't think of in the future either. Now, despite Volkswagen having railed against hydrogen technology for cars, the automaker has filed a patent for a special fuel cell with the Saxon company Kraftwerk Tubes GmbH, thus making it clear that the auto giant is indeed pushing hydrogen technology. And with the new technology from VW, the company looks set itself apart from the rest of the field, which is all focused on fuel cell technology. Now, the main difference to the fuel cells of Hyundai and Toyota is that Volkswagen is set on a ceramic diaphragm instead of the usual plastic diaphragm, and is the only manufacturer of this technology that produces the ceramic membrane in such a way that the fuel cell can be started quickly. Now, the advantages are lower production costs and the elimination of the use of platinum. Now, the target for the breakthrough of this form of mobility is considered to be the so-called solid-state cell battery, and it predicts shorter refueling times with the innovative technology, and we can travel up to 2,000 kilometres, which is 1,250 miles, on a single tank of fuel. And if true, electric cars will be left in the dust. The latest from the controlled opposition, called Stu Peters, or Stupiders, like a recent day version of the Dark Journalist. Both came from nowhere and suddenly have large followings, which is always a red flag to me. Lots of haunting music and dramatic poses for the camera, clown insignias in the background, glitzy presentations all scream clown-based distractions to me. It also went viral, which is another big red flag to me. Now in it, there was the theory about bats causing the COVID virus was brought into serious question by one comment by a Wuhan lab technician who said it could not come from bats as they hibernate in the winter and the virus emerged in the winter. And he said that the genetic sequence of the virus were most like two snakes, and they were proteins from the Chinese krite snake and the king cobra. All of which is interesting, and yet what they didn't reveal is many drugs contain snake serum. Now the factoid on bats hibernating, whilst may be valid, but the point is they don't need live animals anymore when they genetically modify everything now in a lab. And then he spoke about a doctor who was studying COVID and about to release important information and was shot and killed. And that is true, and no papers were released since. Remdesivir, the only treatment being prescribed to COVID patients, contains all the genetic markers of King Cobra venom, according to them, but so do many other serums. And then they revealed the virus or venom is now in the water, and yet they've been poisoning our water for years, have they not? And we're all still here. It revealed Mode RNA co-founder did an article last year using mRNA to treat venomous snakes was the link to the snake theory. And yes, a company was created in California to solely work on creating anti-venom drugs for snake bites called Ophiferix, which was sponsored by the Overlords of Doom and Destruction, the US DOD, the Wellcome Trust funds we mentioned in early expose series, and also the UN. Like I said, we mentioned the Wellcome Trust and the DOD in the expose series. That was 2 years ago. And so it's not new, their involvement in medical shenanigans. Now, the remdesivir that the government, FDA and CDC approved only for COVID treatment, and yet the most common adverse effects in people treated with remdesivir were respiratory failure and blood biomarkers of organ impairment. And this is why in the early stages of the pandemic was the panic over the use of ventilators. Remember that? And hospitals, of course, received more money for putting people on ventilators, $30,000 per patient, I believe. And guess which district used them the most? New York. What they won't tell you is that 80% of New York patients that went on ventilators died. But the hospitals still collected their shekels. Now, the ventilators, as the doctor Ardis pointed out, requires a tube and sedation with morphine, fentanyl, lorazepam, Prazodex, and midazolam. And these five drugs operate on the same centers of the brain that control diaphragm breathing, to shut down your breathing, which is why so many died. Now, the point they missed in all of this is COVID doesn't exist. Yes, there was bioweapons being tested, and it all came under the banner of COVID. But the point is, it doesn't exist in its natural form. It's never been isolated, which means it doesn't exist. It is a common cold and or flu, which is why the recordings for flu plummeted all over the world since 2020, from 30 million down to 1,200. It didn't magically disappear. It was rebranded under a new fear package. And as for the fortune cookie Dr. Ardis received, on the back of it, it said ice skater, and the Chinese wording for it was Liu Bing, the same name as the guy who was shot and killed when allegedly about to reveal the findings on COVID. But perhaps it really meant Dr. Ardis and his sidekick Peters were skating on thin ice. Peters looks and acts like a more polished version of Tank, a former bounty hunter working with the system, who was also accused of being a paid informant by the former NYPD commissioner Bernie Kerik, who was a Rudy Giuliani associate. Unlike Bongino and Joe Rogan, all highly paid by establishment organisations. And that should lead the listener to question their real motives. So given the prominent piece was about the cobra, I went on one of my pondering and researching to see if any connections or pointers can be made. Because truth is always wrapped in lies by the COINTELPRO or controlled opposition. Now in January 2020, just before the world found out about the COVID scam, they launched a TV series in Britain called Cobra. And in season one, a solar flare caused massive energy disruptions, and then political and social problems. Solar flares, energy disruptions, political and social problems. Sound familiar? And then a character's best friend dies of cocaine and fentanyl overdose. How coincidental the opioid crisis unfolded in America just after it. Of course, fentanyl is also one of the breathing restricted drugs prescribed to ventilator patients as well. Now in season 2, a World War II sunken vessel exploded, causing hundreds of deaths just offshore, and rescue attempts were hampered by a cyber attack. Again, much talk of that since. The cyber attack was blamed on Russia. In retaliation for Britain's arrest of two people believed to be responsible for the killing of an oligarch. From which country? Ukraine. Russia and Ukraine. Now, where have we heard that before? And a firestorm spread and rumours of the water supply being contaminated was also in season 2. And the documents then reveal the CIA was involved in the explosion. Well, I never. What a revealing and prophetic show that was. But in April 2021, the US establishment, having been involved in the COVID scam from the outset, decided to unveil a healthcare program called Cobra. The Cobra Premium Assistance under the American Rescue Plan Act of 2021, which was essentially a bailout for clowns, was available April 1st, 2021 through September 30th, 2021. Launched on April 1st, Fool's Day. Who's fooling who? But in the same month, April 2021, a company merger took place involving another Cobra group. Cobra Biologics, a leading international contract development and manufacturing organization specializing in premium plasma, DNA, and viral vector services to support the advanced therapy medicinal products industry. DNA and viral services. Now, where have we heard that recently? Cobra, the snake definition of any of several venomous Asian and African elapid snakes, genera Naja, and Ophiophagus, which brings in the Naga and Ophiuchus, the latter of which means the serpent bearer. The company created by Moderna co-founder Ophiopharynx, all of which sounds like Ophiuchus to me. The snake and the water are related in that piece, and perhaps will provide more tangible connectors. The Sanskrit meaning for snake is Naga, the serpent, specifically the cobra. Now, Naga are a member of a race of spirits, recognized in Hinduism and Buddhism to have mingled superhuman and serpent qualities. They are jinns of the waters and rain, and live in a subaqueous kingdom. The natives of Tibet and Burma are known as the snake people. Ilongsuk in Ukraine means little snake. Remember the snake-like beast, the Leviathan, came out of the water. Which city was the second bombed atomically? Another Naga, Nagasaki, which is connected to Saki. The Saki monkey was a genetic creation going back in time that resembled part ape, part human. And they were said to be very industrious and also intelligent. And it was said they were the monkeys of the gods and are worshipped in temples in India still to this day. And these genetically modified monkeys are said to be the species that built the land bridge between India and Sri Lanka. You can still see that land bridge on Google Earth, as long as they're not pixelating it. But these monkeys were bred as slaves by the off-world and quite possibly related to the Neanderthal species created by the Anunnaki. But of course, monkeys had their own virus that was linked to AIDS and HIV, which is also connected to some strains of COVID. Why? Because linking the two together is Dr. Anthony Fauci and the current Jewish leader of the CDC, Rochelle Walensky, as both were involved in HIV research. Both have lied to the public through their teeth as to the origins, the lockdowns, the masks and the mandates. The government liar brings up another Psaki, Jen Psaki, as the government's voice and face of lying to the public and deflecting the truth. And the final pondering on this is, why would Source create a being that is poisonous to the planet's guardians? The answer is, it wouldn't. And is a process of genetic off-world interference that was all revealed in the four-part series. Snakes and spiders are poisonous to us, just like medication. Remember, it used to say poison on the label. And there's a reason all three are linked, because it all leads to the fake gods and their off-world beings again. Right, we're going to get into an exposé now. Last month, William and Kate, the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge, toured the Caribbean to celebrate the Queen's Platinum Jubilee of 70 years on the throne. 70 years sitting on the same seat. Did she shit herself? Anyway, they spent time in several of the countries visited by their grandmother during her Grand Caribbean tour in 1966, and the Duke and Duchess seemed caught off guard by the virulent letters of complaint and street protests that sought to snap old royal bonds, demanding a new relationship based in reparations for slavery. And the people across Belize, Jamaica and the Bahamas, the three main stops on the tour, expressed their view that the British royal family instigated and abetted the greatest human rights tragedy in the history of humankind. And in the words of one open letter during centuries of settler colonialism, slave trading and plantation agriculture across the Caribbean, and what was supposed to be a public relations triumph quickly clouded over, and yet the Crown's young representatives over the course of their 8-day tour seemed to be on a walk of shame. Now, Prince William tried to meet the protesters halfway by speaking of the pain. Yeah, right. And he said, I strongly agree with my helicopter head father, the Prince of Wales, and I want to express my profound sorrow. Well, why didn't you do that before you left? Or why didn't you do that years ago? Why only address it when someone puts it in your face? And he said slavery was abhorrent and should never have happened. Now, 6 months earlier in Barbados, Prince Charles had admitted the appalling atrocity of the slave trade left an indelible stain on the history of our world. No, it didn't. Just the people who took part in it. Yet again, another example of them shunting the karma onto the many who played no role in it. However, both father and son obscured their family's own centuries-long involvement in the sources, manifestations and unfinished ends of slavery. And the royal family is implicated in one of the largest crimes against humanity of all time, of which they still fail to take proper measure. And what's more, the royals are burdened not only by what their family directly did, but also by what was done in their name. An ungainly extra burden seems to lumber about behind royal tourists in the Caribbean like a leaden shadow. But the story of Britain's role in the atrocity of slavery has a beginning, middle and an unfinished end. As back in 1663, King Charles II chartered the Company of the Royal Adventurers trading into Africa, which soon became the Royal African Company. And the King's brother James served as the governor of the company, later ascending to the throne as James II. And over the coming century, the company shipped more enslaved African people into slavery in the Americas than any other single enterprise during the entire period of the Atlantic traffic in enslaved people. This was all the Jewish-owned ships, just to be clear. And relatives of Charles and James, when they claimed the crown, continued to serve as chief executives of huge slave trafficking companies. Beginning in 1718, King George I, followed by his son George II, carried on the family business in human trafficking as successive governors of the slave trading South Sea Company. And altogether, crews aboard British ships shackled and kidnapped more than 3 million African people over the course of the 1700s, far more than any other slave trading company. By the 1760s, British anti-slavery and abolitionism were on the rise, led by a motley group of religious nonconformists, radical members of the artisan classes, and women's rights activists and black survivors of slavery. Now, amid the developing abolitionist atmosphere, King George III ascended to the throne in 1760, and historians have shown he privately expressed anti-slavery sentiment in some of his teenage writings. However, as he grew into his regal seat, George III actively supported British slavery, proving they have no real power, just the illusion of it. They are told what to do by way higher up. And all because the plantation slavery economic complex constituted an extremely lucrative sector of the empire well into the 1790s. And under George III, the crown served British traffickers and captors of enslaved African people in new ways. After 1783, defeated in the American fake war of independence, George III was intent on protecting, even expanding, the territories of the British Americas. And the Caribbean was an arena of particularly strategic importance, given the cacophony of imperial powers competing for control of islands across the region since 1756 at the start of the Seven Years' War. Now, in order to bolster military prowess in the Caribbean, the Crown bought 13,400 enslaved African people to serve in the West Indian Regiment. And contrary to the accepted view, this means King George III, not personally, but in his institutional and representative role, was one of the biggest purchasers of enslaved people in the decade before the British abolition of the slave trade. Now, in the subsequent years, the Crown expanded its ownership of enslaved black people. In 1795, a major anti-British rebellion broke out and was crushed on the British plantation island of Grenada. And in the aftermath, the Crown claimed possession of the previously enslaved African people on the island, treating them as forfeited colonial property and categorising them as Negroes of the Crown in the name of King George III, A commission was then established to carry out the reparations of forfeited property to affected slave owners. Not the slaves. Including property the crown claimed to hold in African human beings. Thus, through the offices of the crown, African peoples in Grenada, many of whom had fought for their own freedom, were redesignated as slave property. Negroes of the crown were returned to prior slave owners. Others were sold or assigned to new ones, but some remained under the ownership of the crown for decades to come. And up until 1831 in Grenada, Mauritius and in Guyana, the crown directly owned African people as slaves. Just shameful and disgusting behaviour. And really, it was the start of the greed-based I own everything culture amongst the so-called elites. Now, after the abolition of the slave trade in 1806, which is a laugh in and of itself, British anti-slavery squadrons freed kidnapped black people from slave ships by delivering them to various emancipation ports across the Atlantic, such as Freetown, Sierra Leone. And that term is primarily employed in regard to the release of a minor by his or her parents, which entails a complete relinquishment of the right to the care, custody and earnings of such child and repudiation of parental obligations. Emancipation. And the act or process by which a person is liberated from the authority and control of another person. Now, the term is primarily employed in regard to the release of a minor by his or her parents, which entails a complete relinquishment of the right to care, custody and earnings, as stated earlier. But there is no determinate age when a child becomes emancipated. It usually, but not automatically, occurs upon the attainment of the age of majority. Now, one suggests that most of the planet needs emancipation now, needs to be removed from the control of parents, parents like the government and religion. They're the new parents. And these freed African people were often subsequently put into apprenticeships, which meant a return to slavery-like conditions for an additional 14 years, or up to 14 years. And then some of the African apprentices were purchased by the crown, and these apprentices could be forced to serve in British regiments or in public works gangs assigned to building fortifications and roads or to other kinds of urban labour. Although nominally free, they were effectively held in conditions that replicated slavery. Lest we mistakenly think that crown Negroes received special treatment. As one contemporary observer in Guyana tells us, that they worked on the roads in chain gangs with scarcely anything to cover their nudity. And it is true that some royals in the early 1800s, such as the king's nephew, the Duke of Gloucester, were active in the anti-slavery movement. And yet, over and over again, throughout Britain's abolition era, the crown, both as a family and an institution, helped continue African bondage after its nominal end. Now, William, the Duke of Clarence, the son of George III, was the first member of the royal family to visit the Caribbean during his military service, where he marinated in the moral torpor of plantation elites. And by the late 1790s, he rose as a vocal leader of the pro-slavery lobby in London. And he was accompanied in his advocacy for the slave owners by six of his brothers. Now, the Duke of Clarence then became King William IV in 1830. In 1833, when the British Parliament issued a post-dated check for the abolition of slavery, which finally ended only in 1838, it came with the most favourable terms for the slave owners. £20 million, now worth more than £300 billion, or $493 billion in today's money, if calculated as a proportion of gross national product, would be paid as cash reparations to Britain's slave owners for the loss of their right to enslaved people. Just like the banking-style bailout of 2008 then, and yet again, the money never goes to the people affected. Just like the new cash cow of fake donations, Ukraine. Now, in addition, a group of 100 magistrates would be sent to the Caribbean colonies in the name of His Majesty in order to oversee the black population as they awaited their final emancipation. And captive African Caribbean people were directed to obediently continue to serve the slave owners for four additional years on the nasty and brutish plantation estates, even after it ended. And those who resisted were remanded to workhouses and subjected to severe punishment. On June 28, 1938, the man called Queen Victoria was coronated. Just 1 month later, the final emancipation of the enslaved took place across the colonies. And in advance of that day, which was August the 1st, 1838, the following proclamation was promulgated in Jamaica and intended to be heard and heeded by more than 300,000 African people still in bondage in the colony. It is incumbent on all the inhabitants of this our island to testify their grateful sense of this divine favour. We do hereby call upon all classes within this our said island to observe the said day of August next with the same reverence and respect which is observed on the Sabbath. God save the Queen. The sheer arrogance and contempt of them is beyond repugnant. And having paid millions of pounds of reparations to British slave owners, emancipation was presented to the enslaved in the name of the teenaged queen, who was actually a man. And colonial authorities expected the freed African people, young and old alike, to gratify her with their obedience, prayers and thanksgivings. In classic Stockholm Syndrome tactics, that. And in fact, in the name of Queen Victoria, the undemocratic bondage of black people across the Caribbean would continue for generations. Exactly. They spoke only in illusions. And far too many people believe in the hypnotic illusions these psychopaths and vampiric parasites exude. Now, beginning in 1866, after a massive people's revolt in Jamaica at Morant Bay, a strict system of colonial rule, the Crown Colony system, came to be instituted across many of the British plantation colonies. And now, in the name of the Queen, the first and second generations of freed people found themselves even farther removed from the franchise. And for the coming six decades leading up to the time of young Queen Elizabeth II, the majority of Caribbean people had no vote in the government that ruled them. Just like Puerto Rico then. Which is still like America and Canada, which is a crown colony today. And British kings and queens and their representatives were in charge, not the people. And the crown colony was an oppressive regime of rule by strangers, colonial governors, who were always foreign to the people they presided over. A bit like the Jewish in America then. Same system, you see. Same people as well. And the system lasted long after slavery officially ended until the independence era that commenced in the 1960s. Newsflash. Slavery didn't end at all. It just went more subtle and wrapped in the white race also to give the appearance that slavery had ended. In reality, we all became slaves and too few noticed. And because of this history, the crown still represents the continuation of oppressions to many Caribbean people today, as Queen Elizabeth began her official duties in the 1950s, the British government was preparing to beat a hasty retreat from the Caribbean following the guidelines of the Moyne Commission report, which was published in 1945, when everyone was getting killed, at the end of the Second World War, as Caribbean labour movements and nationalist movements reached a boiling point, and the report laid out a roadmap for British disengagement. The British state would offer no remedy for the colonial underdevelopment and deindustrialisation it had imposed on Caribbean economies. Yet again, another example of not having a plan outside of harvest and destroy. And in addition, the Crown undermined Caribbean demands for self-determination and for labour rights, the foundations of people's democracy. Now, when Caribbean nations finally struggled their way to independence beginning in 1962, they're not really independent, they still vote on the UN for the mother country. They did so without reparations from Britain and no long-term capital investment in industrial development or investment in infrastructure or in healthcare or in education to make up for the long-term harm that was caused by slavery and colonialism. A typical response. But therein also lies a problem with the people, and that was echoed in Africa. Because following the alleged independence, why didn't the people rebuild their own country? Why is it in many parts resembling shanty towns? Because surely that's not a good look for visitors or investors, is it? And so that cycle continues, does it not? You can't have the same living conditions out of slavery as you had in slavery. And this is where we the people have to change. There is no excuse to have your hometown or village looking like a rundown estate. And we have to get together as a community and at least tidy it up. And the same applies in America, whether you're white, black or Hispanic. Why would you wish to live in rundown environments? Why don't we take non-violent offenders out of prison and put them to work with your local council to clear the mess up? Now, a 1966 film documenting the Queen's Royal Tour of the Caribbean and produced by the British Colonial Office, why has it still got that name? In its last years of existence, set into relief the irony of the Royals' current day overtures in the Caribbean. Because in the film, we see Queen Elizabeth and Prince Philip encountering gleeful crowds, receiving bouquets of flowers and baskets of fruit from girls and boys, and inspecting the army lines. And it was a trip of photo ops in which the Queen's tourism itself is presented as a precious gift to the Caribbean people. And in her final speech before boarding the royal yacht from Kingston, Jamaica, she said, "I hope my presence among you has made all Jamaicans feel a greater sense of unity with all those people of the Commonwealth, so alike in their loyalty and kindness." What a crass and shameless and shameful response that was. And yet the people themselves, riddled with Stockholm Syndrome, welcomed them like gods. They need to be shamed and shunned. And this royal display is so obviously contradicted by the stations of shame that the Duke and Duchess seemed to receive on their recent visit, which was morally arduous and extremely distasteful, describing it as a pilgrimage. Yeah, pilgrim being the operative word. Another group of enslaved people, and killed people, I might add. That's the Native Americans. The Grim Pill. In fact, both tours are part of the same story and the same unfinished ending. The Crown, for centuries, participated in instigating African servitude and then in perpetuating black unfreedom long after the official abolition of slavery. The Crown left behind a mess in the Caribbean, deciding to depart on the cheap and on false pretenses, and it refused to bear the responsibility for the historical and social harm it caused. And this is why when Prince William spoke of his sorrow last week, it seemed to fall flat. Now, sorrow is a response to pain. Remorse, on the other hand, is the proper response by responsible parties to the acknowledgement of harms they have caused. And remorse serves to repair relationships, including international relationships, by clearing the air and locating the bedrock of truthfulness on which to rebuild trust. Now, the Caribbean people wanted to see and still hope to see actions born of royal remorse for the generational harm committed by the royal family and in the name of the Crown. And this is the core of the Caribbean reparations movement. And they say we can hope that the royal family will renounce the passive voice when speaking of British slavery and own up to the burden of history by engaging in reparations discussions. Only this can lighten the shadow that seems to trail them whenever they walk among the people who are still surviving the legacy of British colonial rule. A very, very sad, in some ways depressing story. But I'm going to go out on a limb here, because I don't agree with reparations, period. Reparations will not fix the problem. That is more based on service to self and gaining from the suffering of other people, some of which go back 10 to 15 generations. How can modern day people gain from the suffering of others? It's just wrong on all levels. The reparations start with the people. They must repair themselves first and then request investment into their country to develop it in a better way. But throwing money at anybody who is not thinking or operating in the right way will lead to disaster. So my challenge to all rundown communities is get together and clean up your own environment. Get rid of the graffiti, the trash and unsightly homes and work together to build anew. Build it and they will come is the anecdote to the current malaise. Some interesting pieces now. What is piercing the veil? Asked one member. And it's fairly self-explanatory when you understand yourself and learn to trust the self. It's not a stupid question, but it's a question that reveals the person is not trusting enough of their own judgments or standing within those veils. Veils are like barriers or hurdles to overcome, not done in a 100-meter hurdle sprint, but done over time whereby you understand each level or veil. And yet we have the delusion of some in the alt media of requesting full disclosure in one swoop. It's beyond madness. The truth, you ask, you can't handle it. In multiples of swoops, never mind one. And it's ridiculously impractical, and it underlines a lack of critical thinking that plagues far too many people. Short-sighted and short-termism is the realms of the government, agencies and military. Why do we wish to replicate them? Because all of them failed. Now, in light of the piece in part 4 of the Cosmic Genetic Series and the Zetas, and carbon is toxic to them, all of which supports the theory, you know how that works out, I put out back in 2013 that in many ways, from overview, it looks like this planet is being re-engineered in favour of other species. It was kind of an aha moment for many people who remember that, Hollywell. Because it didn't make sense. I asked, because everyone was asking chemtrails every week. I asked, did chemtrails make any sense? And do the cabal have anti-chemtrail pills or masks? And do the cabal have access to pure water, given how much of ours is tainted? But the fact that carbon is toxic to the Zeta's biology suggests we need to look at it more closely. And so I started pondering again. Was the series aired in 2018, the same time as the movie Extinction, called Altered Carbon, more of a documentary again? Altered Carbon or Decarbonizing? So let's see what Altered Carbon has to offer or is proposing, shall we? And predictably, it starts way into the future, which is a mind beam implanted into the brain where you don't have to consider it because it's so far in the future, it doesn't really matter. And so then people will not question the future, you see, or indeed the many cases of it being in the now and the past. So the series starts with most episodes in the first season set in the year 2384, which just happens to be an 8 figure, yet again, in a futuristic metropolis known as Bay City. And in the future, a person's memories and consciousness, termed digital human freight, or DHF, are recorded onto a disc-shaped device called a cortical stack, which is implanted in the vertebrae at the back of the neck. Uploaded consciousness technology? All conveniently stored close to the reptilian brain cortex? But have we not been shown these plugins before in both The Matrix and the Stargate One series? And these storage devices are of alien design and have been reverse engineered and then mass produced, but can only be made from the material on Harlan's world. And physical human or synthetic bodies are called sleeves, and stacks can be transferred to new bodies after death, but a person can still be killed if their stack is destroyed and there is no backup. All like a computer or a biobot. And the sleeves are skin suits for the vessel or the clones. And only the wealthiest, known as meths, yes, addicts, in reference to Methuselah, have the means to change bodies through clones and remote storage of their consciousness in satellites. Sat-el-ites. So they never have to die of old age before being re-sleeved. And since the launch of this series, you have to ponder on what is the real use of the relay satellites of Musk and Bezos are doing. Now in the series, Takeshi Kovacs is a political operative with mercenary skills and is the sole surviving soldier of the Envoys, which was a rebel group defeated in an uprising against the New World Order. And in the first season, set 250 years after the Envoys are destroyed, his stack is pulled out of prison by a 300-year-old meth, Lawrence Bancroft. Meth Lawrence Bancroft. So MLB is reversed and becomes BLM. Coincidence? And he is one of the wealthiest men in the settled worlds, and Bancroft offers him the chance to solve a murder, which was Bancroft's own, to get a new shot at life, all of which sounds like a common CIA ploy to me. Now, after initially refusing the offer, he is then interrogated, probably waterboarded by the CIA, and then agrees, and he checks into a gothic hotel run by artificial intelligence. A hotel ran by the AI. Now remember, many hotel chains are ran or operated by the CIA, remember? Now Kovacs finds himself on the planet of Harlan's world, now under the control of Danica, Tribov, who is the daughter of Conrad, the founder. Conrad is an anagram of Drakon. And Danica is in the process of negotiating a ceasefire between two warring sides over mining access. And all too familiar as to what has gone on here, that to me, like the meteor crater and the petrified forest. Now in season 2 it mentions Jaeger activates Project Evergreen. Now, where have we heard that term since? Remember the evergreen ship banking on the Suez Canal for another time meme called 2 weeks? Another evergreen ship got stuck last month in Chesapeake Bay. What are the coincidences? And going back to earlier and the chemtrails, that program is run by a company called Evergreen. Evergreen, always green, adds another layer to the op-ed pieces on green now, doesn't it? Now, Jaeger's Project Evergreen is to double sleeve Takashi Kovacs using an old copy of his stack, a larger version of Team Bubba and Lightforce then, copy and paste. And Poe, Landov, and Ms. Dig build a construct and send Quell and Kovacs to VR, unaware that Jaeger and Kovacs' prime also sneaks into the construct. VR, virtual reality, or the Meta, formerly known and changed since the series as Facebook. Or is it the Metatronic coding construct? Meta is the new city of light pill. Release all your traumas and pains and enter a virtual reality live sleeping pod, is what they're offering. And the show deals with human-machine interface, dealing with gender identity, which is transhumanism. Technology and society, which has come into perspective with the COVID BS. Cyberspace and objective reality, which is the Meta program. Hyper-urbanization that passes up as urban planning, which is the Smart Cities program. Artificial intelligence and paranoia. AI, which is man's greatest threat, and the programs that run off it. The AI virtual reality, or otherwise, will become your new god, which was the same as the last one. As for paranoia or a conspiracy, given this piece, does it look like a conspiracy, or are things unfolding? Now, another important piece of the puzzle is the carbon atom. Carbon is an important building block for life forms, apart from the zetas, and most of a human body's mass is oxygen. And carbon, the basic unit for organic molecules, organic being the operative word, comes in second. 96.2% of the mass of the human body is made up of just four elements: oxygen, carbon, hydrogen, and nitrogen. And so the atoms are the building blocks of all matter, not antimatter. And they consist of three subatomic particles: protons, neutrons, and electrons. Now, protons and neutrons are found in the nucleus of an atom, and electrons are found in energy levels that are around the nucleus. And the carbon molecule has 6 protons, 6 neutrons, and 6 electrons, or 666, or 666, as it was said in the buy bullshit. 666, the number of the beast. The beast to whom, we might add. And that has a whole new meaning again now, doesn't it? I guess I ruined that as well. Local habitation and a name. This piece will may blow some heads away. and may have a pointer to a future. But back in the autumn of 1867, Brian Philip Darrell Duper and other founding fathers of the fledgling city of Phoenix. Duper in Slavic means ass, and it fits. They were picnicking on the platform mound at Pueblo Grande, near what is now the intersection of East Washington and 44th Streets near Phoenix Sky Harbor Airport. And someone asked what this future municipality should be named. And a southerner in the party wanted to call it Stone Wall, after the Confederate general. Another offered Salina, meaning salt marsh, but that too was voted down. And then Duper spoke. This canal was constructed in an age now forgotten, and prehistoric cities lie in ruins all around you. A great ancient civilization once thrived in this valley. Let the new city arise from its ashes. Let it be called Phoenix. Now, both the platform mound and the canal had been built by the Hohokam, who inhabited the basin as early as 300 BCE. Now, the etymology of that word means all used up, or those who are gone. Now, little is understood of the Hohokam, whose largest base was Casa Grande, which is southeast of Phoenix, and their main town was maybe indicatively called Snake Town, near the Santan region. And their neighbours were the Chaco Canyon people and culture. Now, in Phoenix, the flat-top mound shaped like a Mayan pyramid measures 300 feet long, 150 feet wide, and 20 foot high. And lacking draft animals and wheelbarrows, these industrious Native Americans also dug 500 miles of aqueducts to irrigate over 25,000 acres. And the main channels were 75 feet across and 12 foot deep. And that is about as likely as the Mormons building that temple in Salt Lake City. Now, H.M. Wormington, one of the first archaeologists in the region, believed that the construction of this extensive system rivaled the architectural achievements of the Egyptian pyramids or the Mayan temples. And it said Duper would probably have agreed, or perhaps those deemed as Egyptians and Mayans were one and the same beings. And maybe this next piece will reveal more. Because several Odum oral traditions note that Sialtiu Utak was an important leader of the Casa Grande community before the overthrow of the Suwu Ki O'odham, or better known as the Vulture People. Oh my. Now you understand the links to Egyptian and Mayan. It is the Thoth and Set-based Quetzalcoatl group again, who were the Avians. Now, born into English landed gentry, Lord Darrell Duper was one of the best educated men in the American West, and he was classically trained in Paris and Madrid. He knew French, Spanish, Italian, Latin, and also Greek. And months earlier, Duper had been seen in Prescott, the new prospecting town, which is 100 miles to the north. And the primary reason or business was to check up on some gold mining claims owned by his prosperous uncle, whose New Zealand sheep ranch he had helped establish. Now, before arriving in Arizona, Dupa had travelled extensively throughout Australia and was the sole survivor of a shipwreck off the coast of Chile. And Dupa was alluding to the description of the mythical phoenix by the Greek historian Herodotus. At the end of each temporal cycle, this plumed male bird flies to Heliopolis in Egypt and builds a nest of cassia twigs in a myrrh tree as his pyre upon which he will be resurrected. And thus, a new cycle is initiated. Heliopolis was the centre of the cult of Ra. Heliopolis, city of the sun, Ra, and Osiris, the green one. Thus, Omicron is the pale green horse of death. Remember, I've said earlier that the snake is always connected to the tree. Well, a phoenix, as we have found out, is the Bennu bird, or the Benben. And then you have the Benben pyramid, which is the dollar US capstone in Heliopolis, which is connecting Arabia with Egypt, and is also seen rising at the St. John's Divine Cathedral in New York City. Now, birds are related via the falcon also, which symbolizes Horus. So how did Dupa know all this? And was this naming random, or was it predetermined? But perhaps we'll find out why. The saying, birds of a feather always flock together. But I wish this set of birds would just flock off. And perhaps it's no accident that most of the first citizens of Phoenix, including Dupa, were Freemasons. John T. Alsop, for instance, was an attorney, judge, and the first territorial treasurer and the first mayor of Phoenix. He also served as the first worshipful master of Arizona Lodge No. 2, as well as the first Grand Master of the Masonic Grand Lodge of Arizona. And even earlier, he had been first master of Arizona's first Masonic Lodge called Aztalan, located in Prescott, the first territorial capital. Now, Aztalan and Aztec means white or pure, and yet they have their own meaning, it seems, because Aztalan is a new Nahuatl word meaning the place of the heron. Bear with me a second. Now, the Aztecs inhabited this mythical land after emerging, they say, from the seven caves located in the bowels of the earth. And so the Aztecs were the underground people. And so either part of the ETs below there or one of them. Now, the heron is thought to be the naturalistic model for both the phoenix and the Bennu bird. I will post that picture now. And the Egyptian sun cult, the Bennu, was found perched atop of an obelisk, or sometimes upon a pyramid-shaped stone of meteoritic iron called a Benben. Now, the obelisk is the symbol of Osiris. as a primal symbol of morning and new life. The Egyptian heron passes with flying colours, it says. And likewise, the Bennu embodies the morning star Venus, appearing each dawn on the laurel tree in Heliopolis. The morning star is Lucifer and Luciferia. What a coincidence is, I just watched a show called Feria, involving demons and time travel, different dimensions. What a convergence and coincidence that is. Now, of course, Lucy is reference to Lucifer also, and also the MKUltra LSD done by the Tavistock creative group called the Beatles. Lucy, Sky and Diamonds equals LSD, the infamous red pill the alt-media clowns duped the public with. Now, this ornithological curiosity is also the incarnation of the heart, or Ab, of Osiris, and the soul, or Ba, of Ra, two primary deities related by a simple palindrome, Abba. And in addition, the heron and the Bennu were among a small number of animals, including the hawk, Horus, and the serpent, Ra, in which a discarnate soul could inhabit for as long as it wished. Indeed, they did, with their immortal status via the Metatronic Coden done by body snatching. Now, the hieroglyph for Bennu means both purple heron and palm tree. And one denotation for the word phoenix is purple red. And consequently, the Phoenicians were known as the Red Men. And even today, residents of Phoenix, Arizona, are known as Phoenicians, or phony C-I-A-ans. Now, the Red Men is not native to Americans either, to be clear. It is the Pleiadians, who were tomato red, that roamed this planet thinking it was theirs. Phoenicians, they are called for a reason, when you go back in time long enough. Now, the flag of the city. Give me a second again. Get ready. The flag of the city is a stylized white phoenix on a purple background. And that's just being posted in MeWe. That picture will look familiar to THI members. And another possible pointer of the true intentions of the trustee. When backed with her reluctance to listen and not mention the Israeli Elites, and also sending money to Tel Aviv just after they'd blitzed Lebanon, leaves many questions about her going in wrong directions. And the fact she is close to, whether knowingly or not, to A and the Freemasons in Scotland raises more concerns, as perhaps this next line reveals. Because in a tome called Morals and Dogma of the Ancient and Accepted Scottish Rite of Freemasonry, the 33rd degree Mason Albert Pike states that the phoenix was a quintessential alchemical icon. And in this regard, J.E. Serlot, Dictionary of Symbols, remarks, in alchemy, the phoenix corresponds to the colour red, to the regeneration of universal life, and to the successful completion of a process. but the rejuvenation of life they speak of is death by blood, hence the colour red, the Red Army and the Red Dragon. Now, some Arizona prospectors may indeed have been seeking spiritual gold. And is it more than a mere coincidence then that the Phoenix, whose centre of worship was the pre-dynastic city of the Sun, should lend its name to what would become the largest city in the Valley of the Sun? All of which reveals the cult of Ra and his disciples Thoth and Set, and the avian flying serpent known as Quetzalcoatl. It can be a representation of the serpent, it said. Why? Because Ra was known as the snake people. The flying part is the avian group of Thoth and Set. And the depictions in the carvings on the Temple of the Sun is not a feathered serpent. It is the solar rays around the serpent's head, hence the Valley of Sun, which is the Valley of the Sun of Ra. And now, Aztalan is furthermore conceptualized as an island in the report, and some speculate that the name even refers to the legendary continent of Atlantis. That we know is not true. And according to the comparative linguistics scholar Jean D. Matlock in the Last Atlantis book, the Aztalan of Nuuatl mythology was really called Aztatlan, referring to the village of the Nayarit on Mexico's western border. But the Sanskrit word Asta means place of the setting sun. The sun sets, which means it goes dark, just like Set. And Matlock suggests that this could actually be the westernmost boundary of what was once Atlantis. Nope, it was Florida. But did Lord Duper and Judge Alsap consciously try to merge Egyptian and Mesoamerican mythologies in the wilds of Arizona? Was the establishment of the Aztalan Masonic Lodge 1 and the Phoenix Masonic Lodge 2 an attempt to symbolically merge Prescott, the Heron, and Phoenix, the Bennu, in the same way they would soon actually be linked by stagecoach? And was it a clandestine Masonic intent that a new Atlantis called Aztalan would rise in Arizona and a new Heliopolis, Phoenix, should be its heart? Arizona has much to uncover, correct or disassemble, or we can engage in an adult, civilized way. And much work needs to be undertaken in the Four Corners area going forward, and one hopes it is the start of real change on this planet. To the Phoenix and the Bennu Bird, you will be. I bet that last piece got you all pondering. Particularly in THI Arizona. Right, end in peace. I've received a number of messages from members recently, all espousing their own individual life improvements due to this show and the group. And this is what it's all about. And I get a lot of satisfaction seeing people building or rebuilding their lives in a better way. For too long we have dragged each other into the gutter. And now I'm seeing large signs of people not only elevating themselves, but helping each other as well. You know, the suicide prevention, people are coming off meds, alcohol, drugs, religions and cults achieved by THI is often overlooked due to the powerful nature of the shows. But it is the psychology side to the show that really drives what we're all about. Now, it's 7 years since I mentioned the importance of shadow and inner work, and 7 years since the explanation of the two worlds, and 6 years since I warned about masks coming down, and in 2020 we would see. And that was every member's opportunity ahead of time to fix or correct themselves, and many have, and that pleases me immensely. Some have fallen in that time, but they stand out as a minority now, and that is the big shift of why THI is different. Now, one thing that has to be worked on is getting involved in the dramas of other people. It serves no one well and creates a lower vibrational pattern within you and those around you. And if you are asking, is he talking about me? Well, the answer is yes. You just self-confirmed it. Hate, revenge, lies and projections have no place in our lives. It's all low vibration and all personal reflections of the self rather than the person or people they are projecting at. Now, they say there's a thin line between love and hate. I strongly disagree. There is a huge line between it. And it is indicative of the metronome wildly swinging again. And the absence of balance allows the person to swing wildly. And it's no different to the drug or alcohol abusers, from the high to the low. And then more abuse is required to get the high again, following the inevitable low again. But hate and revenge and ill-speaking of others does not make you better internally. It only lowers your own vibration and you are back or stuck in the astral again. Honesty with ourselves is the key. Make yourself honest within and your external interactions becomes a whole lot easier. And if the four cosmic genetic shows didn't make you realize the implications of continuing the failed old hamster wheel of life, then the next phase will not be kind to those people. But that is their free will choice, just like the jabbers. They chose their own path, and we have to accept their choices. I just showed you a path. I cannot walk it for you, and neither can anyone else. Because like spirituality, it is a singular journey only. Along the path, you will see and meet others, but in much reduced numbers. And the focus is not on the loss, but the gain. Always remember the gain. The soul family and the future of our species far supersedes the blood family in terms of importance and the overview of life. There has always been pioneers that boldly went forward and blazed the trail for others, to boldly go where no one has gone before, so to speak. And what we are achieving here is creating new pioneers to boldly go where no one has tread for many millions, if not billions of years. A chance to end the limitations imposed on us here. There will still be issues and wars in other dimensions, but we will have many more tools with which to face the dark forces than we ever had here. But if we fix here, the ripple effect will resonate right through the universe. Be proud of yourselves for the progress you've all made. But in this matrix, time doesn't stand still, and neither should you. Standing still means you go backwards on the conveyor belt of life. Why waste that progress and opportunity? Progress, shadow work, learning and understanding to develop the highest consciousness form of wisdom is an ongoing process that never ends, be it this lifetime or the many others that follow. And many people within and outside of our group have tried to undermine me and the group. Guess what? They all failed. Why? Because we stood in the truth. We exhibited honour and integrity and pushed upwards with the right ideas, ways, plans and goals. It is our time, and we all must make that opportunity stick and last, as their world collapses at an all too frequent pace now. We must build, not destroy, a new one filled with hope on the avenue of life, filled with joy, happiness, love, compassion, caring, sharing, in a cooperative way. Which world do you want to be on? There are no fences to sit on anymore. The gap is too wide for that. Progress and advancement or stagnation and loops. The choice is yours as always. But it requires far more work of everyone to achieve the former. The organic world or the inorganic digital experience. Organic points the path upwards of personal responsibility and self-governance. The finger guard digital lifts the middle finger to you that controls time. The child level digital controls your time and life. The adult organic has no time and you retain personal control. And so thanks to you all who made me happy with your progression. Keep rolling. This has been the Truth, Honour and Integrity Show. My name's Thomas Williams. Bye for now.